welcome to the Globalization Institute podcast. I'm Alex Singleton, and I'm speaking today with Kwame Owino, an economist with the Institute of Economic Affairs in Nairobi, Kenya. This podcast was recorded in April 2006. Kwame, Kenya has been a major recipient of development aid. What's your take on aid and how it's spent?
Okay, I think the major claim many people in the West, when they use that word, is this fatigue about the fact that over 40 years, African countries, developing countries and low-income countries in general have been supported with what is quoted to be massive amounts of aid, and there's nothing to show for it, or there's very little to show for it most of the time. As a matter of fact, it's the major claim is that perhaps it's possible that the massive amounts of aid that are given to these countries is a major driver of corruption. And I think while criticism of aid and the way it's been delivered is valid, I think some of those statements are overstated for the reason that if you look at how much aid has been given to a majority of countries in Africa and Kenya that I'm more familiar with, it's important to put them against some context. So when you say it's massive aid, it's important to say against what. And often when you look at the real figures, and especially the figures that are given with no strings attached, or without other considerations such as security policy and all that, basically directed towards development, it's not as high as what you get the impression it's not as high as what the claims are. The major problem with aid has been that aid was given to countries that were within the political situation at that time of the Cold War. So there's very little in terms of governance reform that went with the financial assistance. So what it did instead was entrenched governments that were completely undemocratic, and therefore they became increasingly autocratic and authoritarian. And over time, of course, I think aid gets blamed for having done that, and it's just partially responsible. But I think there are many other factors. At the same time, if you look at the landscape, countries toward the south, the global south, have not necessarily received the same amount of assistance. It's been dependent on many things, and part of it is, of course, has been policy and the predilections of countries in the West. So some countries have received it much, much less than others. So it's to say necessarily that aid is failing is basically a very hasty generalization in my opinion. But that is not to say that it doesn't have its problems, and it's true that without reforms and significant reforms in governance, more often than not, aid just helps to oil the corruption machinery.
So you're saying aid shouldn't just be a blank check?
It certainly should not be a blank check, and I think one of the things that it tells us is how do we, what are the more efficient ways of delivering aid? I mean, there are ways in which in modest successes that aid has registered, including in Kenya itself, and I think people should ask them, how do we ensure that more efficient ways of delivering this is available? And there are some. I mean, among the options should be that government should not take it for granted that all aid and all financial assistance must necessarily be channeled through the public sector. Governments perhaps should have to compete for that aid. And this does not necessarily mean that it should be channeled through what is called the civil society or the third sector, but basically even including direct assistance. I mean, if more often than not the data is there and it's possible to find data right up to the household level, then if the purpose of the aid is to assist with education, then perhaps a voucher should just be drawn and a check cut for every family for that purpose, which should be used directly. And this can be monitored vis-a-vis what the government's expenditure has been. I'm sure some research perhaps and some discussions around new ways of circumventing government, and I'm prepared to say that governments, corrupt governments especially, authoritarian governments especially, should be circumvented, including some governments that we've had in Kenya.
In Kenya, of course, at the moment, there's a big issue around corruption. How do you think that's playing out, and what can be done to fight it?
I think the main thing has been that there's been a lot of noise. It's the equivalent of a spinning wheel. Sorry to take us back to the 16th and 17th century. But it's not enough to spin the wheel without thread or without the silk. I think nothing comes out of it. So that basically is what the government has done. A lot of labor. But even the policy and the laws themselves were drawn in a very interesting way, in the sense that disclosures. Consider that the public sector is the largest employer in Kenya in terms of numbers. And apart from employing doctors and nurses and basically all manner of clerical people and teachers alone in Kenya about close to 300,000-400,000. individuals. All of them are required to make individual, disclosures on forms, to fill up disclosure forms talking about their incomes, both from the public sector and from alternative businesses that they have. Those forms are then kept and sealed and kept in private. Kept outside the public scrutiny. So really, in my view, that is not disclosure. Unless it was possible to audit those forms and actually look at inconsistency and be able to field questions. It is not enough to, because that basically just becomes an annual ritual. It is even possible, as has been claimed, that some people have simply filled in their names and sealed the forms without necessarily filling in the blanks. So there's no purpose. It just adds to the cost of the public, of maintaining and keeping those forms, basically in terms of warehousing and all that.
And this information really ought to be up on the internet.
In my view, that information should be available for public scrutiny. And why? Partly because the main reason is that all these are people who are paid by through public resources. And so they should not claim any private interest in withholding that information. So yes, I think unless that is available to the public, of course by electronic means, yes, and through other mechanisms, but of course electronic means would be the most efficient and most useful.
Conditionality is often seen as a bad thing. What's your take on that?
I think conditionality, like many other words that have been used, have become cliche, and to a large extent many people think of it in negative terms. And it all came about because of, associated with whatever many people call the Washington Consensus and the IMF and the World Bank. But on the whole, I think it needs some expansion. The concept needs to be expanded and to be understood. If conditionality is taken as basically whenever a lending agency, whether in a bilateral or multilateral fashion, requires a specific government, irrespective of wherever they are, to adhere to some conditions, in my view, then that is not necessarily inimical or harmful to the interests of the citizens of that country. The problem has been that there have been very little disclosures of what conditions government are asked to adhere to as part of a lending package or part of a grant. And so what happens is many clever governments in Africa, including other parts of the world, whenever they've messed up on a significant policy initiative, then try to shift the blame by saying, hey, we did this because of conditionalities and we were untwisted into it. And that to me is not really a very smart argument. But of course, sometimes they do tend to get away with it.
Is this because the IMF doesn't come out and say specifically what the conditionalities imposed are?
Certainly, and I think what needs to be explained is that these are not necessarily conditionalities. They were discussed under some agreed framework and actually agreed. But when most of these negotiations and discussions take place in a non-transparent manner, then it is very possible for one party or the other to claim later that I'm twisted into it. So I guess that is perhaps what has been happening. And so for that reason, the World Bank, the IMF sometimes get a bad name for just because there was not sufficient disclosure about what the discussions were and what the expectations of the part of either party would be.
The US government has moved towards the Millennium Challenge Account, which it started very slowly. It started giving money out to countries that meet certain minimum criteria in governance and so forth. What do you think of that as a sort of new approach to conditionality?
In my view, I think it's a good approach, and it is informed by the fact that I think reforms and support do not take place within a political context, and therefore, hand in hand with the provision of health services, I think governments at the same time need to initiate some political reforms. So basically, what the U.S. government seems to be saying is that fine, it is not enough for us for you to justify your need. At the same time, you must show us that you're making this kind of progress. So basically, the requirements about what governments should adhere to. And because they're done upfront, and the requirement is known, then governments that think they're sufficiently incentivized to accomplish those will actually apply. It's hard problems, but on the whole, in terms of principle, I have nothing against it. It's a positive step.
The World Bank, the IMF, are they forces for good, or do they cause more trouble than they're worth?
I think to say that the World Bank and the IMF are forces for good, are trouble is would be, I think would be a little, is to overstate this, the fact. I'm more familiar with the World Bank, and some of their work in Kenya. And on the whole, they try. But the problem about the IMF or the World Bank, more particularly as I was mentioning, is that Kenyans do not understand what their mission is. Many people do not understand their mission. And therefore, the expectations from them is not necessarily based on what their mission is, but a perception of that mission. I'm not too sure that they've done a pretty good job in telling people or letting people understand that when we deal with your government as their interlocutors, this is our expectations and this is just as far as we will go. The backroom dealing, which many people think is what takes place and where most of the decisions take place, I think gives everybody a bad name. But on the whole, it's fairly open. It's very easy to get responses from World Bank, and I think that's been my experience in Nairobi particularly. I have no experience about the decisions that are taken in Washington or elsewhere. But on the whole, the World Bank officials in Kenya tend to be more forthcoming with information. Of course, some information perhaps should be gotten from governments, and it is possible to be directed to them. But on the whole, I think if you say with an understanding of what their vision is, I think you say that sometimes the World Bank does just its best or tries as much as it can. But of course, it could do better by making people one understand its mission and also be committed to a more transparent approach to any agreements that it has with government.
There's a big push for greater spending on education in Kenya and in Africa as a whole. You believe that free open source software is a way forward that can save a lot of money for developing countries wanting to get greater access to computers.
Yes, I mean, there are millions of children in Kenya who are in primary school. And one of the things that the government has been thinking about, or rather that's being argued, is it's important to begin to introduce information technology and e-learning in schools. And if you think about it in Africa, I mean, or in Kenya, the PC penetration is very low. And in my view, part of the problem has been not only in terms of the acquisition, because the cost, basically, especially for clones, is quite...
Hardware costs.
Hardware costs have really come down. The software costs are the major problems. I mean, if you consider in terms of, in real terms, hardware costs have come down substantially over the last 10 years. It is not the same with the cost of proprietary software. So, it is obvious that there's a significant alternative in, I mean, there's an alternative in open source software. And in my view, if I was to craft ICT policy, the public sector should have, the default position should be that open source software should be the first call for all public sector work, IT work. And that proprietary software should only be an alternative when all these others, I mean, when there's a very specific reason for it. The unfortunate thing is that it is the reverse. Many people think that proprietary software is the only alternative. And if you look at the ICT policies of many countries in Africa and in the region, and in Kenya in particular, open source is not mentioned at all.
And is Microsoft pushing its Windows products and Office quite heavily in Kenya?
Yes, it is, including a recent discussions with the government to be able to provide, of course, through some concessions, software for schools, an introduction to schools, and which is good, but I think you could also, as a cynic, I mean, think of that as part of early entrenchment. Because if you get Kenyan kids to get used to, I mean, to be acclimatized entirely to Microsoft products, it would be very, very difficult for a switch to take place.
But it's still very expensive for those products to be bought.
Yes, on the whole, I think the policy for Microsoft in developing countries is to try and make software basically affordable. But if you think about it, for a person who's faced with a decision about buying new IT equipment, the software costs are significant and are often the bigger barrier to the acquisition. And that, I will not support piracy, but there's no secret as to why piracy is as high as it is. Because software costs are just completely, in some cases, genuinely unaffordable.
Often higher than the cost of the hardware.
Yes, it is possible that software costs could go higher than the cost of the hardware.
You believe that Kenya has a good future in call centers and that agriculture is not something that Kenya is particularly good at. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
For a very long time since independence, the mainstream idea is that Kenya's strategy for developing and for expanding incomes and developing the economy will be through an agro-based industry. Having looked at the data, my view is a bit different. I think that for a population that is growing very, very fast against a country that has less than 15% arable land, it is very highly unlikely that agriculture will be the way. And given the cost of commodities, basically agricultural commodities in the world markets, the general trend has been that the general trend on average is that they are actually decreasing. So that tells me that perhaps we should think about something else. And services, which already have a significant proportion of the GDP, maybe the option. Which now brings me to the question of call centers. I think by the end of this year, the main monopoly in terrestrial services and basically IT services in Kenya, and telecommunication services in Kenya, Telkom Kenya, is going to be privatized. And the monopoly is ending. Actually ended officially last year. Barring an extension, call prices and the cost of most telecommunication services will come down quite significantly. And what will this will provide is the opportunity for very many Kenyans who have 12 years of education or so to be able to acquire jobs. To serve in back offices, basically back office operations, whether call centers or some other financial services that would require clerical work. And I see that as there's a lot of scope for growth in that one, because education in Kenya is basically based on English, so Kenyans are competent speakers of the English language. They have a flatter accent, and so would be acceptable to people in the West.
They actually have a better accent, you would say, than Indian call centers.
Yes.
Because it's flatter.
Certainly. Compared to the English, to the South Asians in general, the Kenyan accent is much flatter. So perhaps would be more acceptable to people out here. And that has been confirmed by people who come to Kenya and have visited South Asia as well. So it's not just speculative. And of course, in recent times there's been quite significant investment by, of course, Kenyans were based abroad, but most significantly an investment that started last year. Close to 2,000 or 3,000 people will eventually be employed to provide that kind of service to call centers. So yes, it is there. Regionally as well, Kenya has far better infrastructure. And once the fiber optic ring that's being established in the country is connected to a submarine cable on the East African coast, this is expected to come, to begin to work in perhaps 2 years at the most, then I think everything will be in place for some takeoff.
Kenya has become big in producing cut flowers for sale in Europe. What's your view on how that's going?
The argument has been, or rather, there's some evidence that many people, given the performance of coffee in the world market over the last 10 years or so, the last decade, a few people have opted instead to transfer and to begin to grow cut flowers because there's a significant market in Europe. And of course, there's a possibility of its expansion to North America. Of course, the competition from South American countries will be significant, but obviously there is a market in Europe, and that can be the scope for its expansion as well. So that's a good thing. And at the same time, of course, Kenya, because of its, as part of the Cotonou Agreement, Kenya has has concessionary access to the EU. Because of the African, Caribbean and Pacific Agreement and the Cotonou Agreement. So that has also provided that. But quite apart from individuals, I think various companies have also invested in huge farms in places in Kenya basically to take advantage of that market. So there's cut flowers, of course, and some vegetables and horticultural products as well. They have done this without any government support, or even any call for subsidies or some kind of protectionism or privileged, any privileges, and they've done fairly well. They've provided some jobs. Of course, many people argue about what the environmental cost is, and many of them anyway have declared that they're actually trying to, they do adhere to the environmental regulations that have been passed in Kenya. So to a large extent, a majority of them are actually doing a good job and providing the jobs that Kenyans need, and at the same time providing products that are required and that have demand.
In fact, the government tried to stop coffee farmers from switching.
Yes, for a long time in Kenya's law, especially the Coffee Act, it was actually a criminal offence to cut down coffee bushes. It means that, people were compelled to keep a product on their land which they did not require. And that's an interesting thing in terms of basically people's rights to deal with their property as they wish. But of course, as coffee continued to do badly, I think many people who were defiant, basically got away with it, and many more Kenyans did that. So after time, of course, it began, that force, I mean, it may have been in the books, but it was completely useless. So it was repealed.
Kwame, thank you very much.